Yeah, here we are. Rock to Recovery Radio, episode fill in the number of your choice. This is Wes Geer. I am your host. Thank you for being out there. You're listening to KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM. I got to get more excited here. Come on, let's do this. Laguna's only FM, Human Crafted Radio. This show is also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. A lot of programs out there. New Vista has several great ones. Everything they do is great. Mental health, addiction, all sorts of stuff. If you're looking for a program, check out New Vista Behavioral Health. So, as I said, I am your host, Wes Geer, and I always kind of started off with, what the heck are we doing here? Well, I'm a sober dude, and I'm really passionate about recovery. Wow, my life got bad. Woo! Wow, it was bad. Somehow I didn't die. Like so many of my friends, I mean, every week we're losing people to mental health, to addiction, suicide, wounded warriors, etc., etc. So it's funny, I was having this intuition, like, I think I'm supposed to be on the radio. I didn't really necessarily want to. And funny enough, KX93.5, Jason Fetty, they offered me a show. And here we are. And so the idea of the show is that alone we perish when we feel alone and lost. And together we help each other and we recover. We realize, we learn that our stories aren't the only one that was like that. We're not the only one that went through what we did. We're not so terminally unique. There's other people out there just like us who went through stuff just like us and recovered. And in talking about it, it destigmatizes it and it gives support to people. And so that's what we're out here doing. We're you know, trying to help save lives and build this community and make it an open forum so people can be comfortable and talk about whatever it is. It could be sex addiction. Talking about multiplying. No, I don't know. Bad jokes. Okay, but it could be mental health. It could be sex addiction, gambling, right? We've had wounded warriors on here. So that's what we're doing. And tonight...
I gamble every time I have sex, actually.
Right?
Yes.
I had a doctor that said that, and he says, isn't sex such a pain in the butt? I was like, what do you mean, doc? He goes, you have sex. It's like, you want to get married? Are you my girlfriend? Do you have an STD? Are you pregnant? Do I wear a condom? Do you have... It's like, oh, my God. Thanks for...
Do I wear a condom? Do you wear a condom?
Yeah. It's so complicated. Mm. Anyhow, so tonight I've been really excited because I have somebody who's a friend that I care about. He's a neat dude. And I'm excited I'm excited to hear your story. I always do a little Googling and try to find out stuff.
No.
But I don't want to find out too much because I want to be kind of like, you know, Christmas, just like the audience. You know, what's in this box? You founded, this is going to give away who it is, the DeSanto Clinic, right?
Clinics. Now.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Listen, that was amazing. Wow. Okay.
We self-fulfilling prophecy name.
Yeah.
Named the plural, so it kind of looks
good.
Stupid just having one clinic. So
since I want to get married and have kids someday, on my mailbox, I should just put the Geers.
That's it.
Even though it's just me.
I don't even have a cat now.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have a cat. I don't have a dog. But on the mailbox, it's going to say the Geers. Dude, I'm getting schooled already. Mm. Doctors are smart. So,
oh, yeah.
and I first met you. Well, I don't know where I first met you. Was it on the radio show? Prior to that?
No, I met you through Angelina.
Yeah.
And at a Trace Vistas Recovery, you were doing, and Angelina said, you got to meet Wes Geer. We had you on our radio show
first.
That's
right, yeah.
And that's where I got to know you. You came on right before Rock to Recovery 2.
Yep.
Promote that show.
To promote that show. Yep. And it was love at first sight.
You and Nate Lawler.
Yeah.
How's Nate doing?
Nate's good, man. Yeah. He's good. He's just surfing his brains out, which makes me happy because it makes him happy.
Good for him, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, you had a radio show called...
It was the Recovery Show. Dr. Joe and Angelina, and we're on iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
We still exist.
Yeah.
We had a good run, 2.5 years.
That's rad.
Like, doing that once a week, you know what it's like to do an hour. We did 2 hours, booked our own guests, had to come up with 102 shows.
That's a lot.
Worth of topics.
Yeah.
Locking it out on our own. Yeah, it's... And now we're starting to do the TV show, so we had to give that up to be able to do this. So. With the Share TV, yeah.
Right. So we might as well plug that. So our friend John Stipik, he's starting a recovery network that's already got, I think, licensing deals or whatever the right word is with Roku, Apple TV, mm-hmm. and maybe Google Play or something like that. And it's going to be all recovery-based shows, but not just recovery, but there's going to be cooking and health, so it can appeal to more than just people battling whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And both Rock Recovery Radio will be on there. And
my show's going to be Inside Addiction. It's going to be kind of an interview show. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be interview based, but it's going to be topical and it's going to be question and answer. I had an idea that I wanted to make it look like, you know, the new Letterman show on Netflix, and my next guest is. I wanted it to be a casual couch to couch kind of thing, you know,
that's
easy
cool.
chair to easy chair. So it's going to be, you know, just like you and me are sitting next to each other like this.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of touching, you know, a lot
feeling,
of
caressing. Yeah. All that kind of stuff as I scoot my chair closer.
Yeah. Come here.
So I didn't finish the intro. So this is Dr. Yeah. Joe DeSanto, who has been an addiction specialist for 15 years.
Yeah.
And has 7 years sober.
Do the math.
Now that is interesting to me.
Kind of scary.
Yeah, but I mean that's what we do.
Yeah, I was helping people while I was destroying my own life.
Oh, I can't wait to get into that. All right, so let's get into it. I always start, you know, each week because I feel like different people's stories start in different places. Some people are like, my childhood was totally normal. I felt great, and then whatever. For you, where does it start? Who is Joe as a little dude? How was it?
Little Joey?
Little Joey.
Little Prince Joey.
Oh, Joey. Yeah, because you're Italian,
I had a normal
huh?
life. Everything was good.
Yeah.
I was raised by a pack of wild codependents.
Oh.
Yeah. In a three-story brownstone in Brooklyn, in a little neighborhood called Dyker Heights. And I lived, it was three stories. My great-grandparents lived in the basement. My grandparents lived on the first floor, and me and my parents and my sister lived in this little two-bedroom, small 800-square-foot apartment until I was, you know, in first grade.
Trippy.
So we were all on top of each other.
Literally.
And it was great, literally.
That's cool. You're like, I got to go down and talk to Grandma.
I'm going to go down and talk to Grandma. Grandma's going to make me food. And so,
yeah.
I started out, okay, so the first
what
floor had...
This? What year is this?
Oh, God. 71, 72.
Okay. Yeah. Are you sure? Or is it 61? No, I'm just kidding.
No, get out of here.
I was kidding. I just want people to have, I like the imagery. It's radio. So
I'm
71.
Well into my late 40s.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, it's Brooklyn and it's post-depression. You know, we had pre-depression and post-depression living in the family. And then, you know, my dad was the first person to make it in the family as a professional. So he was a dentist. So I was always looked up to him. And I always had to outdo the next person. So I always had to be the best in the class, best at whatever I did. So I had to be a doctor.
Who?
Yeah.
Well, who made you feel like you had to outdo people? That's on you.
God for giving me this brain.
Right. That's your default setting.
Yeah.
Funny. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you had to outdo people.
I don't know. That's
how you felt, though.
Yeah.
That was your reality.
Some
people don't feel like that.
I don't know. I can't imagine not feeling like that.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
Well, we had Mike Catherwood on last week, and that certainly wasn't his issue. He's like, whatever. I'm just going to be blue collar my whole life. Next thing you know, he's on Regis and Kathy Lee. But the point
is... No, I would be scared to death. I mean, this is totally fear-based.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, I don't want the wave to catch up to me and... Were
your parents like, hey, Joey, you better get a job?
No, they weren't. They did everything for me. I had no coping skills. When I went to college, I was let loose without any coping skills whatsoever. That was the problem.
That,
and a taste for alcohol. You know, my uncles made alcohol. I would be drinking on fishing trips. I'd drink at the table. I'd drink and nobody would notice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
the 70s were like that.
Yeah.
Alcohol was just like, yeah.
An Italian family, alcohol is nothing.
When did you have your first drink?
I don't know, 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah. What was it, some Chianti?
No, it was Wild Turkey in a cup of tea.
What?
Yeah, whenever I got sick. It was Wild Turkey.
Right.
So I got sick a lot.
Is that a hot toddy?
That would be a hot toddy.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, how I knew that, I don't know. That's cool. And did you like it or just like, this is gross, but I'm sick,
No, I love the dizziness feeling, you know? And then I discovered codeine cough syrup. So when,
what age?
So I developed a chronic cough on nine, second grade. How old are you?
So you had a quote chronic cough?
Chronic cough. Yeah. My
so you
mom
were drug
would bring
seeking
me,
at nine.
I didn't know it then.
Right.
But I was.
Yeah. Wow.
Awful.
No, but I get that. You know, we talk, what I like to talk about a lot on the show is the similarities, not the differences, right? Somebody might be going, well, I was never a doctor. I wasn't in Brooklyn. I didn't do cough syrup. No, but did you seek drugs and not know you were seeking them?
Absolutely.
I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Absolutely. And I was doing that as, you know, as my drinking and drugging career went on, and it was casual up until a certain point, and it was recreational up until a certain point, and then...
So high school, you're drinking, you're just one of the boys, not a big deal, a few vomit episodes?
No, you know what, maybe one or two, you know, I didn't drink a lot in high school. It's not like I got primed up and ready to roll. I drank appropriately. We had some parties, I was I was on the swim team, so we drank at swim team parties. The heaviest I ever drank was a split a bottle of Jack Daniels with a girlfriend of mine at the time, and don't even remember the night. It was awful.
Like in high school?
High school. And her, you know, her dad had to drive me home, and it was just awful. I couldn't even.
And
couldn't go back there.
Yeah.
God knows what I did.
It was just like kids being kids, right?
Yeah.
I did that at 15. Drank a pint and like, I gotta be home in 20 minutes, and did not go well.
Yeah.
I get it. So so you get along with your kind of family, they're just doing everything for you, making life easy, but nobody was like being a jerk. There wasn't ACA, there wasn't
No. And there was never any abuse. I mean, you know, after the fact, you know, after I got sober, I learned from my mom that she had a problem attaching to me. Super codependency, not really knowing how to be a mom. Sorry, Mom, I love you. but, you know, I mean, she admitted this to me. Not a lot of holding, not a lot of touching. And, you know, during those first couple of months, it's so integral to having those dopamine pathways built. You have to have the connection.
You mean when you were an infant?
Yeah.
Not a lot of holding and touching.
Not a lot of holding and touching.
But I thought you said later she was too codependent. Well,
you could be both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So you think you're a doctor, so you're saying that when you're an infant, maybe not having enough touchy-feely stuff affected you.
Yeah, it's absolutely. Studies have shown that families, that moms that attach to their kids have less, you know, adverse childhood experiences as they get older, like addiction, like divorce, like problems with drugs, interpersonal relationship issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so
good to know, yeah.
So, yeah, I was, I went through high school not really having a problem. And then I got into college and I was just on my own. And it was off to the races.
Well, just hearing, even without the addiction, sounds like you had grew up real fast in that scenario. But did you have any anxieties in high school, or you just fit in? Everything was cool. Swim team, it's all good.
I had to go back and remember my anxieties. Mm-hmm. But had I not gotten sober, I would have looked back and thought, there were no problems.
Right.
But after getting sober, I looked back and realized I had the most severe anxiety disorder. And I had buried insomnia as a child.
Ah.
You know, and that's usually indicative of some kind of childhood abuse, which I never experienced. And I've been through tons of, you know, hypnotherapy, psychotherapy.
Okay.
But I just had insomnia, and that was always a problem. And, you know, insomnia is like leads to addiction and alcoholism like you wouldn't believe. Mm. Crazy, crazy cause.
When you unpacked the anxiety, you went and revisited it, what did it feel like?
It felt like
painful, scary.
Yeah. It lonely.
Lonely.
Yeah.
Like hard to connect with people?
Absolutely.
That's where it was for me.
Right?
It's brutally so.
You know, and then you drank. I don't think there was ever an involvement with a woman in my early dating years where I wasn't like there wasn't some kind of drinking involved. There would always have to be a six pack of Zima,
sure. Yeah.
Bartles and James.
Zima, I remember Zima. It was all clear.
The wine cool. Oh, Zima.
Bartles and James was actually a good time when you're young. It's easy.
Oh, yeah.
But so you didn't really remember it, but when you remembered those anxiety stuff, was it very painful to go back there and visit that? Do you think it was from being hurt?
It was painful because I felt bad for that boy. You know how you have to go back and you do experiential stuff. You talk to yourself at 5 and 7. You know, I felt really bad for that kid.
Yeah. Did it come? Do you think there's any damage with people hurting you when you're young? Because I had to go back and revisit stuff. Because like you said, you go on with your life. You don't look back. You're here in this time, this year, doing whatever. But when you do go back, when I looked at it, I can look at things that people did. Not that I'm trying to play poor me victim, but that really hurt me and set me up kind of as gun shy. Like, well, you're going to hurt me again. So now I'm fearful and I have anxiety because I don't know if you like me or not because the other people hurt me.
Like how so? Like, for instance.
Oh, no, you're not turning this on me.
No, I want to hear. I want to hear because I'll give you an instance. I mean, I was an overweight kid, so I used to get bullied.
Overweight?
By men. Oh, huge.
I love how guests, they just want to, you know, they're ready to go up into their, like, into their adult life, and they want to skip over how they're overweight and bullied. Is it a little anxiety? Yeah. Let's talk.
Oh, no. It's the basis of everything that's wrong with me right now.
Yeah.
Right, I should say.
I remember wearing like all white and it didn't really match and I didn't know what I was doing. And so they're like, your white doesn't match, dude. And then this kid came up and laid behind me. And then the other kid pushed me down and tripped me in the dirt. And I lost it. And I was a skinny, underdeveloped guy, but I threw him against the wall. But I was just like, why would you hurt me like that? You know, why are you picking on me? There's a lot of that.
You grew up in OC?
Yeah, that was it. That was in Orange County. Yeah. So that, you know, a few of those episodes and you're like, you get gun shy. But you had the same thing. You were picked on as a kid. You're overweight.
Yeah.
They're calling you names.
Yeah. I mean, a food addiction at an early age. Looking back,
I like
it was
how
soothing.
You almost left that out.
It
we were at
soothing.
The Joe was the young guy.
Well, we'll hop back and forth.
I'm just playing, dude. So food was an addiction at an early age. It was soothing.
Oh, good God, it still
Plus
is.
Plus, you had grandma probably making all sorts of good Italian stuff, huh?
How could you not?
Right? In that time, in the 70s, home cooking, there's no Del Taco.
No. Del what? Not in Brooklyn. No way.
What was your grandma's favorite dish or whoever your favorite dish back then?
Oh, she would make, just Sunday would be pasta day. So anything. But I remember just lasagna.
Uh-huh.
Just like.
And that's in the days where they're like, come on, don't you want another second serving? Oh, come on, little Joey.
Yeah.
You're like, sure, I'll have a ninth piece of lasagna,
Oh,
Grammy.
And the guilt, it's still, I can't leave anything on my plate, so I have to have small plate. No matter what I eat, it cannot leave anything on. I mean, and I had a grandfather who was a cop who would just berate me if I left something on the plate, so I had a lot of...
Right, that's it was damaging
a mess.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Now I got a picture for who Joe is. Yeah, man. Painful stuff, man.
I mean, it is when you have no point of reference and when you can't process it properly.
Right.
And when you got to look perfect for your parents, you know, everything. Maybe I did need to look perfect, but I felt like I needed to. I always felt that love was conditional. I don't know. I don't know where the hell that came from, but.
Right. Because you had to live up to these certain standards and you're getting pain and picked on. Yeah. Yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, good stuff. I can relate.
Thanks for bumming me out, Wes.
That's what I'm here for, Joe. That's what I'm here for. So, all right. That paints a nice picture, you know. So that you had the food thing going, you had the cough syrup thing. It makes a little more sense than I just had a thing for cough syrup. You had a lot of other stuff going on to fuel that. And again, anybody listening at home, we're not playing the blame game. It's not like, you know, it's your fault. It's not that. It's looking realistically at how we're feeling and why were we reaching for these coping mechanisms.
Exactly.
1 + 1 = 2. It's kind of obvious. Yeah, yeah. And then, hey, sometimes people have perfect lives and they still just love to get loaded for whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said it wasn't too bad, the drinking in the high school. When did it take up to that next notch and get crazy?
Well, then I realized that in college that I could drink a certain amount, feel a certain way. And I learned how to modulate everything really, really well. I knew when to do, you know, a lot of recreational drugs came into play. So cocaine came into play in college. It was the 80s, right? Late 80s. So cocaine was all over the place. And alcohol was a fraternity college I went to. So alcohol was just, you know, you were handed a beer on your first day. Basically, yes, you were handed a beer on your first day. I remember vomiting on my first day. So Thursday night would be drink until you puke and then drink again until you puke. So there were two drinking sessions
for you
delineated by vomiting. For me and a select few.
Yeah.
The knights of the round table.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know the fraternities are like that. I didn't go to one, but I get it. But sometimes we think we're doing the same thing as everybody else, and we go, oh, wait, everybody's not puking three times a night? Oh.
Yeah.
But they were.
But I wasn't doing it that often, and I was pre-med, and I was doing well, so I couldn't, you know. Plus weed, cool. Plus mushrooms, plus ecstasy was just coming around then. So, you know, you go back and you tally up, and you know, sometimes you don't know how many times you go to the ATM in Vegas. This was kind of like that in my college career, looking back and realizing what I did to my brain before it was even developed.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. You're pre-med, so you're kind of going down the road of health, wellness, understanding the human body. Is any of it clicking as this is kind of a contradiction to my life's work?
Wait, you're assuming that doctors are healthy.
Well, my father was a doctor, and he got emphysema from smoking.
There you go.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
That's a struggle of mine also.
Yeah, yeah. Well, nicotine. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a tougher drug to quit.
Mm. Yeah. I quit opiates, didn't quit tobacco. So.
Yeah, Especially when you get sober, too. Yeah. So... cocaine, ecstasy, pre-med, you're still pulling it off
and doing it with other pre-meds, you know, finding the right people to do the right thing, so you didn't feel like you were, you know, too much coloring outside the lines, because that wouldn't be acceptable to me.
Right. Anybody ever pull you aside and go, you know, like people you did X with or whatever, and go, yo, Joe, you're kind of pushing?
No, because there was always a line. I never crossed that line, and I never appeared to have a problem. Even in my worst of addiction until the very end, I didn't really, nobody really knew. It was a shock when I came out and told people that I had a real serious opiate issue.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. But I'm jumping ahead several years.
No, we're doing great. Yeah. I like it. I love this because I get to know people on such an intimate level. It's cool. We sit here and share this. And I think people at home, they listen too, and it helps them feel human, right? When we're vulnerable like this.
Just because I have an MD after my name does not make me any less imperfect than anybody else, man. It's.
Do you think it made you cocky at all being in med school? Like, I'm in med school, I'm, you know.
Occasionally I felt that way, but I never, when it came to my profession, and it still is to this day, people always tell me, you should wear your profession with more pride. And I don't look at it that way. Mm. I look at it as, especially now since I've gotten sober and I really value my license, I look at it as an honor and an absolute privilege. What percentage of the population gets to call themselves a physician?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Which teacher, healer, it's crazy.
It is crazy. So, our boy Ernesto's waving his hands around. What are you telling me, Ernesto?
He's flailing.
Oh, yeah, I know all about that stuff, yeah. So, yeah, let's...
Ernesto, you don't like my story?
No.
He does. He loves it. So we're going to put in your song now because we're starting to get into it. Is this the Madness one?
Which one are we playing first?
The one that's...
The Cult? Yeah.
Yeah, well, you want to set it up?
This kind of embodies how I felt during the 80s when this, you know, when it all seemed to be okay.
Okay, good.
And this song just rocks. And plus, the song rocks, so I love the song.
Who was it again? The Cult. I mean, what song again?
She Sanctuary.
Okay, so this is Wes Geer on Rock to Recovery Radio, KX935.com, here with Dr. Joe DeSanto. He's telling us a story of the... craziness in med school. And this is The Cult. We'll be right back.
I love it, dude.
Yeah.
I love it.
I see this.
What's up, y'all? Hey.
My back cry, and I'm glad to try.
The cult is so cool. So that's when you're getting high on Molly, doing blow in the 80s. Everybody's on blow. You're in pre-med.
Yeah.
You feel connected. You're doing okay. That's what it felt like.
No. Medical school felt totally disconnected. Felt totally. And I was in New York City, too. I went to med school in Brooklyn. And
what was the name of school?
Downstate.
Downstate.
State University of New York at Downstate.
My father went to George Washington.
Oh, GW. Yeah.
GW, yeah.
Nice. Good school. My school was it was a county. It was associated with Kings County Hospital. So I got a good training. I was in the trenches. Mm. Like you'd go to the ER and there'd be gunshot wounds. Shot after patient after patient after patient. Mm. So it was pretty cool. It was high adrenaline and worked hard and partied hard.
Mm-hmm.
And got a good 4-year career. And then that's when I moved to Los Angeles. Married my first wife at the time. I've been married twice.
Okay.
Soon to be number 3.
Congratulations.
We'll see. Thank you. Yeah. She doesn't know it yet.
Well, she
kind of does.
Okay, as I say, if she listens to this.
She's awesome.
She is awesome.
So, and I moved. We got married after medical school, barely knowing her.
She was in school too, Ben? She's
No, this is my first wife. Yeah, we went to med school together. And we moved out to L.A., and within 9 months, we were divorced.
Wow.
Yeah, just L.A.
Why? Drinking and using? Was it dysfunctional foundation?
Yes. Dysfunctional foundation. I had no interpersonal skills whatsoever. I'll take not total responsibility, but I'll take my half.
Yeah.
And not nurturing or cultivating it. So, I mean, that was my first go-around.
How was the breakup? We're just like, oh, good, get me out of there. Or did you have breakups can be tough?
No, it was. I was like, yeah, I felt like I dodged a bullet on that one.
Mm.
But we're friends now, and we kind of go back and looked at the without getting into detail. There was infidelity, so on her part, and it was painful. So yeah. again, rejection. There you go.
Yeah, rejection.
But then
not
followed,
being good enough.
But then I was by myself and I could do whatever I wanted, and that's what I really. I didn't admit it to myself, but that's what I really wanted. So being in Beverly, being at Cedars-Sinai, being a resident there, and having an MD. That's when the MD after my name really came into, really became an asset, because now it's
you're kind of a rock star.
It's the mid-90s. Yeah, in my own mind, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, come on, doctor. Girls love doctors. Marry a doctor, marry a lawyer.
I got to go to the Playboy Mansion for a couple of parties.
I've never even went to the Playboy Mansion.
I figured there you go. So I was hanging out with the girls that were dating, the basketball players and the LA Kings, So I was hanging out with that crowd. And
how'd you get mixed up with that crowd? Because you're practicing in Beverly Hills.
You know somebody.
Yeah.
I actually, when I went into private practice, I became the Sony Studios lot doctor. So I got to drive around on a golf cart around the studio. So I'd go from, set to set.
What year is
married
this?
With children. So to give you an idea, I'm 93.
I didn't know that about you. That's cool. And were those people like, hey, Dr. Joe, my elbow hurts?
No. I was never approached to do that. I never
could probably say on the radio anyhow, because you're still an MD. You have to protect yourself.
No.
Just wink twice.
Well, yeah. I wink 3 times.
Okay. Mm. Gosh darn it. Mm-hmm.
I was able to, able to function while pushing the envelope.
Being
able to function of using, but it was not obsessional. It was not obsessive and it was not compulsive.
Yet. You weren't like doing lines and going to the lot.
Nope.
Right.
No.
Or not getting loaded on the job.
No.
More like an off hour thing.
Correct.
Right.
And then.
What was the main thing you were doing? Just random coke, whiskey?
Cocaine and alcohol, and the cocaine was very intermittent. It was because I was afraid of, I didn't want to get busted and I was just, I was just doing my thing.
Now you're a doctor. Were you ever just going, I'm a doctor and I'm using cocaine, which is.
No, because I knew other doctors that were doing that. Never seemed. The things that I did were very impulsive and never seemed out of the ordinary.
Okay, I get that. Yeah. Well, and in one of our text too. It says our alcoholic life seemed the only normal one, right? Yeah, that's a big one for us. Where we're like, what? Everybody else does it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it was just total justification.
You never did cocaine and put on the like blood pressure thing and said, hey, I've got 182 over 97 or whatever. Like,
no,
I'm
but
really
I,
tweaking balls right now.
No, but I walked 3 miles once from my apartment to the Cedars-Sinai emergency room where I was actually a resident and told them that I had drank too much alcohol and took too much no-dose.
Right.
And they looked at me and they went, uh-huh, huh. Come lay down. My heart rate was like 160. I got called in and they kind of asked me if I had a problem. I denied it. You know, I was a little depressed, little, you know, getting over my my first divorce, which was like, you know, years ago.
Oh, that's so what you told them?
Just
that was
making an excuse. Yeah, yeah, and that's when the excuses
really
started.
They're like, Joe,
really
that was
started.
4 years ago.
Yeah.
So you're depressed and what? You stay up all night on no-dose? Yeah,
yeah.
Just, you know, journaling.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's I like that. So
scrapbooking. Mm-hmm.
Did they give you some Xanax, some downers, Melio?
Yes, I got. Of course, of course.
That's why you went there, right?
No. I thought I was dying. I couldn't feel my heartbeat. Thought I was dying. Anyway.
A doctor. That's,
yeah.
Let's think about it. Let's ruminate in that. A doctor
yeah,
does so
in.
Much blow. He thinks he's dying. His heart's. Yeah.
Good God! Now that you put it that way. That was one night. You know, everything else, I had it under control every
yeah.
other time.
Well, I just think
you have
it's,
to understand that.
I do. You are so under control, Joe. That's what we're getting
yes.
in this story. The control. That's it's painful. Well, you know, it's the thing is, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, an athlete or a doctor or whatever. The drugs do the same thing to everybody, regardless of what your knowledge is, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I was interested in this too because I think sometimes I was wondering if this would come into play and we'll see. But sometimes when you know, that's the worst thing. Like if you're in the position, like, well, I know how all these drugs work. You kind of could get cocky. I didn't know if that would be a situation. Like,
no, I think the cockiness and the entitlement came from, well, if I could prescribe this for someone, then I, of course I could take it.
There it is,
ad
right
lib,
there.
You know, as much
yeah.
as I wanted. Especially, so this is what happened. So. OxyContin came on the scene,
mm-hmm.
Lortab, and hydrocodone, Vicodin. All of the drug companies now realized that they could now talk doctors into making pain the most important thing that they had to treat.
Mm-hmm.
So to do that, like any good crack dealer, they're going to give their first couple of rocks are going to be free.
Right.
So they used to give out samples.
Right.
Physical samples of Vicodin, oxycodone, you know.
It just doesn't make sense.
In big cases that they would just drop off in my office sitting behind my desk. And they sat there for a long time. And then one day I hurt my back and I took a half. That's how scared I was. I didn't run into it, you know, head first. And just a half of a tablet and I was done. At that moment, I didn't realize that my whole life had changed with that half a little red tablet.
Huh. What happened? You just had to be on it all the time?
It was great. It was amazing.
You didn't realize it, though.
I didn't realize that. I kept saying oh, my God, all I have to do is take a half of this once a day.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get home, and I could get so much done. I went to go work out. My yoga was the best it's ever been. And they keep bringing cases and cases of it. I said, how could that be bad? And the drug companies are telling you that it's not addictive.
Right.
Which is another.
That is insane.
Yeah.
They knew it was. They just lied.
Oh, my God. Of course they did.
They just lied, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Big Pharma is, I shouldn't say totally responsible. People are responsible for what they put in their own bodies, but come on now.
Negligent, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised. Well, I'm not surprised, but that's for another show.
So what took it up a whole other level for you.
That took it up a whole other level. And again, I still didn't realize I had a problem. And back and forth with, you know, samples and prescriptions and not realizing that I was let go from a job because I started to become unreliable and never putting that together with what I was doing. So I never really saw. And I moved a lot. So the moving kind of coincided with me not doing well at a job. And then I would join another practice and there would be, you know, it would get better for a while. Like we do geographics,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And
got to move over here. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's great. Oh, my God. All I had to do was move. And now I'm sober again. You know, this is fantastic.
And then you take you with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Take you with you. And then you realize that, that it's happening all over again. But you still...
didn't realize it.
Yeah, and I had enough time in between where I was sober, and it was great. It was working out, looked great, felt great. You know, had two children along the way. And then I really injured myself, and I went into really high-powered opiates, and that's when it was all over. That's when I really needed... My ex-wife had my daughter at that time, and I was laid up in bed. I tore my hamstring off the bone.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It felt like I had been shot in the rear end, mm-hmm. and the pain wouldn't go away for weeks.
How'd you do that?
Kickboxing.
Huh.
Yeah, weekend warrior kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
And
I'd like to point out, though, that while you were addicted to opiates, you have a marriage that's functional, you're having kids, there's two houses, three cars,
yeah. Two kids.
Yeah. So, and that's important because, like, when I was at the height of my meth addiction, I was signing my first record deal. Like, you can be successful, but we love to
On the upswing.
That. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
We love, or seemingly outwardly successful, and we love to use that as, well, it's dangerous, right? Because then we're like, well, we don't have a problem, right?
Yeah.
I don't have a problem because look at all this that's going on for me, you know?
And I don't know how you felt, but I always felt like I don't need to do this tomorrow. But then tomorrow, it's like
right.
every other good drunk
yeah.
or addict.
It'll stop tomorrow.
You're just, and then you realize you're in a prison, and then you realize you're screwed.
So what was the, you tore the hamstring off your butt bone,
mm-hmm.
and
it was like 2010. I got sober in 2012, so it took 2 years for it to unravel.
So how much oxys were you doing a day?
At the height, I don't think I've really talked about this too much, but anywhere between 75 and 100.
75 and 100
tablets
of what milligrams?
10. So about 1,000, I think at the very worst, about 1,000 milligrams of oxycodone.
It's a lot of damn opiates.
It's a lot of doctor shopping I had to do. You know, I always...
you're doctor shopping as a doctor. Was
yeah.
it easy to be a doctor?
Of course.
It's like, hey, Bob.
I had a great script. I had, you know, and I was able to detox myself in between that. I was always able to space things well enough and, you know... Being, I was the boss at work and just killing it again. So everything was great until it wasn't great.
This is when you had the DeSanto Clinic?
No. This
That's
was before.
Later. Were you working in addiction, though?
I was. I had a small addiction practice, and I was taking care of addicts. I got my Suboxone license back in 2006. That's when it just came out in, you know, early 2000s,
yeah.
where it got really popular. And I was helping other people, and they were looking at me kind of pathetically while I was trying to help them, and I was a really good they had to have known, and I still keep in
Your
touch with some of
pinned.
My old pinned and I'm just chatty, and it's pathetic.
Yeah.
Wow. You know good opiate addict that just don't.
Yeah. Did anybody come up to you later and go, dude, I went to you for help and I could tell you were more loaded than I was?
No, but I had patients who were actually, at the time they saw me, they would hold my hand like they had problems, and they go, we know you've got, you know, couples and or a patient. That happened to me 3 times. They grab me and they go, you have a problem. You need to get help. And, of course, you're in total denial. First of all, you're scared.
I don't have
yes,
a problem.
Exactly.
You've got to be mad.
You need
mad.
To get the hell out of here right now.
That's
How
ins-
dare
that's
you,
insane.
Madam.
Now, when mm-hmm. they, okay, and then when we believe our own lies, right, like you get so in actor mode that you – believe it, right? At least for a second. Get out of here. What are you talking about? But then did it ever hit you?
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, it was hitting me then.
You know, it was? Even
yeah.
Though, okay.
Oh, because it was, you know, the Dr. Hyde.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Jekyll standing right next to me going, mm-hmm. tell him you don't have a problem. You know what I mean? It's
so you had some shame and guilt over that.
Well, what saved my life and how I got caught is I took pills from a patient. Actually, didn't take them. I didn't take them from the patient. I switched them out for non-narcotic pills. Okay, because I was in sick withdrawal. Okay,
you're in withdrawal.
Okay, so you're a chronic pain pill patient,
yep.
right? And you come into my office, and I go, "Hey, well, let me have these for a second." When they're not looking, you switch the medication.
Yeah.
And I looked, and I realized what I had just did, and I didn't care because I was in such withdrawal. It was such an impulsive, stupid thing. And it's the thing that got me caught, and it's the thing that almost lost me my license, and it's the thing that made me come to Jesus. That was my come to Jesus moment.
Yeah.
Realizing that the amount of shame and guilt and it was unbearable. And I tried to end my own life on April 9th, 2000. It's actually the morning of April 10th, 2012, my sobriety date. When I realized that I couldn't go back to work and I couldn't be a doctor anymore. I thought I was gonna lose it. I was gonna lose everything.
So how did the guy catch you?
He took the pills to a pharmacy, and the pharmacist said these are Tylenol.
Uh-huh.
You know, because he took them. First of all, they didn't look anything like that.
It was the
stupidest thing I could have. I didn't do it because I was not smart or stupid or anything. It was impulsive and
you're powerless.
If you're in withdrawal from opiates the way I was, mm-hmm. I didn't care at that moment.
Right.
And I was wondering how I was going to die. I knew I had people come up to me probably a couple of weeks before that, leading up to that, saying, "You look like you're going to die, Dr. Joe. You look like you're going to die." And I thought they were just, you know, exaggerating.
Oh, calm down.
They had really meant it. Mm-hmm. You know, I had lost a tooth.
Oh, man.
Because of opiates. I still didn't put two and two together.
But I want to hear, like, how the guy found out, and then what happened when you got caught?
I got called in, and they said, Do you know about this? And of course, I still denied it.
Yeah.
And then that night, I knew that I was going to get caught. They said they were going to have an investigation. I said, well, you know, I still was like trying to figure out how I was going to get out of it.
Right.
And then I tried to kill myself that night. And
how?
Car running.
What happened?
In the garage. It didn't work. I woke up on the kitchen floor. I didn't even know how I got there. I woke up on the kitchen floor around 4 a.m.
So you could be dead.
With a headache. I looked around. I went, wow, heaven looks like my kitchen.
I should have done the dishes.
Yeah. I'm like, well, at least I picked a nice oceanfront place to live in heaven.
Joe, you could have been dead.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you should have been dead.
I had two kids. It was just the amount of shame and guilt.
They were in the house?
Overrode. No, they weren't. They were at my other house.
Okay.
And so I woke up. I woke, came to at 4 in the morning in severe withdrawal, and I made the phone calls that I was dreading making. I called my parents, and I called my ex-wife at the time, got them on conference call, and I told them both that I had a problem, and nobody knew. Nobody knew.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I don't know what to do.
And then what'd you do?
I called the number on the back of my insurance card.
Uh-huh.
Said and it was Mission Hospital. It was literally a half a mile from where I used to live in Blue
Hedrick
Lagoon.
Was Hedrick there?
Had Dan Hedrick saved my life, man.
Oh, man.
Dan Hedrick was...
He gets around.
I'm telling you, if it weren't for Dan Hedrick and the other doctors that they introduced me to, who had issues at the same time, who had issues in the past and they had recovered, I don't think I'd be here talking to you.
That's huge.
It was really, really, when Dr. Hedrick, when Dan Hedrick put his arm around me and he said, I've been through the same thing. And I looked at him and I went, are you kidding me? Like, I didn't know that other doctors had this problem. Again, uniquely, what did you call it?
Terminally unique.
Oh,
and that is how, Alcoholics Anonymous started, right? Was you know, one alcoholic talking to another. And he was a doctor and an alcoholic.
Yeah. But
that's what we do. We go, oh, I'm not alone. And that's why we're here on the show. Your story can help people. My story can help people. And even addiction doctors get addicted. I mean,
I know. What the hell?
If we put this in a script for Hollywood, they'd be, oh, it's too obvious, guys. Right? So tell me, there was another suicide attempt. So you told the whole family, like, oh, gosh.
Well, there was just one.
But that was it?
Yeah, that was it.
Just one. Oh, man.
I can't go there. The depths, I don't even want to talk about it. It was a real, like, darkness that you might have been there. I don't know. I don't know your end of your line, but...
A lot of shame and guilt. There usually is, isn't there?
I didn't think anybody had the amount of shame and guilt that I could have had at that moment. That I abused my the thing that I had was my identity for 44 years. Boom. Gone.
See, that's...
Gone. Or threatening to be gone. I had no idea. I'm in rehab and I'm like waiting to hear, you know, waiting for the DA to come by. You know, I didn't know what. But the medical board and Kamala Harris, I love you, Kamala. She gave me a second chance. Kamala Harris was the district attorney.
Like
I'm sorry, the attorney general for the state of California who oversaw my case. And the medical board wanted to take my license. And by the time I had my hearing, I had already had 2.5 years sober, and I had already started working for Hotel California. I was their medical director. Mm-hmm. And I started putting together some really good relationships and some people that knew me sober.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know me back in the day. And I wasn't a bad person back in the day.
You were a sick person.
I was sick.
Yeah, man. I love this, Joe. I love it.
I was sick. And it was just I feel sad for my old self. I feel sad that I was such a good person. Like, I really cared about people, but there was no caring connection there. I didn't act like I cared about people, but I knew I cared about people. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense.
Okay.
Because we become drug and alcohol's B word. That's what I say, right? Yeah, I never meant to do all the jerky things. My mom had cancer. I didn't visit her in the hospital. It wasn't that I didn't want to, it's because I was so tweaked out. First of all, I couldn't leave the house, but I get it. This is what happens. But I love that you're telling the story of that there's that way out. So let's play this song here, right? Now, this is Muse. By the way, Doctor has great taste in music. That's another thing. Mm-hmm. It's not Engelbert Humperdinck or something.
See, another stigma about doctors.
Right, totally,
broken
totally.
Yeah.
My dad was cool. He got me piano lessons, and he was cool, man. Okay, so here we are with Dr. Oh, and I didn't do anyhow. I'm not the best radio host, but whatever.
Yeah, you're good. Amazing.
Dr. Joe DeSanto telling his story of addiction and how he overcome it, and thank God he didn't die in that suicide attempt. This is Wes Geer, Rock to Recovery Radio, and this is Muse.
I can't get these memories out of my mind, and some kind of madness has started to evolve. I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah, I have finally seen the light, and I have finally realized what you mean. Now I need to know, is this real love, or is it just madness keeping us afloat? But when I look back at all the crazy fights we had, it's like some kind of madness was taking control. Yeah. Now I have finally seen the light, and
my
Yeah, sing it, Joe. That's such a good song. So why'd you pick that song?
Because it's a song that I used to play on our radio show. It used to be one of our solid, you know, constant bumpers. And I just love it. I love Muse. They rock stadiums, man.
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's how you feel in your sober life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly it.
Uh-huh.
You know it. And, so got sober in 2012 and stayed in a 12-step program and did it. I did it. I didn't know any different. And I did what was told to me. I finally took direction. It took me a couple of sponsors, and it took me a little bit, but I finally listened and did stuff out of my comfort zone, and actually, you know, stopped worrying about what people thought about me.
Yeah.
For a second, you know, and it was those moments of vulnerability that saved my life, literally.
Yeah, and I think vulnerability, a word that goes with that, is humility too. You know what I mean? What's interesting to me is a couple things that you weren't too contemptuous. Like, I'm a doctor, 12 steps. What? Because it's kind of esoteric. You're going to work some steps and it's going to make me what? I mean, I could see somebody scoffing at that because, you know, medicine is more data-based. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I said I need to see the evidence.
Did you really?
But we hold the – what does it say in the first forward? What is it? We hold this to be we hold this truth to be evident. You know, mm-hmm. we of you know the 12-step
yeah.
program.
The doctor's opinion yes. and all that.
No, the further forward. The forward
I know
to
what
the
you're talking
edition.
About.
Yeah.
I can't quote
right.
it.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, and we really shouldn't talk about it on the air.
No.
And and I can't anyway. So sorry, Mary. So all I saw was, I remember my first, I can talk about this. I remember my first meeting, just walked in there and I said, oh my God, you get to just talk about what's going on in your life. So I remember I just raised my hand and said, this is what's going on, you know,
yeah.
not understanding the whole concept of the share and what you had to, so there was no experience strength. It was just an S show.
Yeah.
And, but little by little, I started hanging out with all the broken toys and I realized that, and then I saw a couple of doctors in the meetings and I was like, oh my God. And they're normal and they've got families and they've appear normal on the outside. I said, I'm going to stick around. I'm going to see what's going on here. And I stayed active in both alumni programs of the treatment centers that I went to and eventually got a job through one of them, through somebody that I had known from Northbound.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Northbound. I did 60 days at Northbound, a tremendous program. Mission Hospital, followed by Northbound, 90 solid days. Two meetings a day in those 90 days saved my rear end.
I love that you did that. I still think it's impressive that a doctor did that and didn't try to shortcut it or whatever. That's so cool.
Last house on the block, baby. You know, mm-hmm. I was looking at, I didn't know, potential jail time. Who the heck knows? Everything. It was
right,
because
this is before they...
Yeah, yeah. It was before, and I didn't even get a notice that I was that anything was going to be sanctioned until my first year of sobriety. On my first birthday, I got a letter from the medical board saying, "We heard what happened. We'd like to talk to you."
And you're freaking out, yeah.
Of course, yeah. I mean, yeah. But
what'd you do? So what'd you do? Like, you know, how'd you get through those tough moments?
I went to meetings.
Got support.
And I got support. And I looked around and I said, you know what? No matter what, I'm not going to drink or use. And I'm going to have these people around me.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, that felt okay.
And how did you deal with the shame and guilt?
Oh, it took a long time. I mean, man, it still comes up. When I go to sign contracts with people, I've got to let them know what happened to me. That's one of the mandates of the medical board.
Ah.
You know, you've got to wear the scarlet letter.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, and it's understandable because some doctors do really, really egregious things.
Yep.
I did too. But it was against myself. You know what I mean? It was, you know, and little by little, you have to make amends. And, if you forgive enough people, you learn to forgive yourself. Because that was always a problem. How do I let this go? How do I become the healer that I really wanted to be if I still have this this wave that's following me. I'm ready to crash on me. And little by little, I'm telling you, through working the 12-step program, it's just it dissipates, and not because you're running faster. It's just the wave seems to just disappear. And yeah. It's one of those swells that just come right behind you, and you think they're going to be bigger, and they just die out.
I like what you said, how you have to forgive other people to forgive yourself. I think that's a big thing, because we all come in, we're mad at a lot of people. And it's funny that we're like, hey, I'm sober now. Forgive me. You guys, forgive me. Look at me. But we're not so fast to forgive. And they go hand in hand. We get sick drinking the poison of resentment that we hold for other people.
I'm more resentful now than I was in the beginning. You know, when your butt is sore, it's easy to be grateful. You're like, thank God. Yeah. Now it's like, what the? You know, it takes a lot more work to stay sober now than it did back then. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That's interesting. It's
just because you start going through deeper and deeper layers, and the deeper layers are the ones that you really got.
Right. Not everybody does those.
No, that's why people don't stay sober. I'm telling you.
Or they just are cranky. They're like they do what it takes to stay sober, but they stop. And then those are the ones that when you see them, you're like, man, you're kind of a weirdo. Or they bum you out. So we're almost out of time. There's a couple things you wanted to say about the hotline and whatever. I've really loved your story. I loved your vulnerability. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
There's a...
I just want to give a little shout out. And Jody Barber invited me to speak at the International Overdose Awareness Day. And that's August 31st from 6:30 to 9 at the Club Rancho Niguel. And that's in Laguna Niguel. And we're all going to be, she'll be speaking, talking about her movie Overtaken. And, if we lose any more people to overdoses,
we will.
And we're going to. I mean, it's not getting any better. Well, it's getting worse. The numbers keep going up. So we just have to keep, yelling it from the mountaintops.
Yep.
We have to. And I'll give a little bit of my experience, and I don't know what I'm going to talk about, but I know it's going to be from the heart, and I'm losing people every week, literally.
Your experience, strength, and hope. I thank you so much for making that 4.5-minute drive from your house in Laguna Niguel. I love you to death. For everybody tuning in, this has been Dr. Joe DeSanto from DeSanto Clinics. Sharing his story, his experience, strength, and hope. The message here is this disease knows no boundaries of socioeconomic class or anything. It takes anybody out. But
knows no pay grade.
Knows no pay grade. If you're out there suffering, you are not too sick. You're not too different to get this thing and recover. There's people like Joe and I and hundreds and thousands of us all over the world that want to help you recover. So remember that you're worth it. And we love you. We love helping you.
My office is in Costa Mesa.
There you go.
DeSantoClinics.com.
Come see him. All right, this has been Rocked Recovery on KX935.com. We're out.
KXRN LP Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX 93.5.